you go through hard things? What do you do? What do you say? Are there any trends that you have noticed? Go ahead, take a moment, consider it. How do you go through hard things? It's important to think about what we do first, even important to consider what we do second. But what do you do in the long run when the initial shock has worn off and it's still really hard? I mean, it's not too difficult through self-discipline and social pressure to respond well initially. But it's another thing when you're worn out and you've been dealing with it for a while. When the money finally runs out and the bills pile up. When the wound is repeatedly reopened by that person and trust is destroyed. It's when we've lost all strength to even continue. How do you go through hard things? Now, it's important to just state some obvious things here first. Every hard thing is hard. It's just challenging. It's painful, right? Sometimes it's baffling, but it is never fun. Also, some things are harder than other things. And so we need to respect each hard thing for what it actually is. But thirdly, it's important to state that my hard thing might not be all that hard to you, and vice versa. And so when we consider how we go through hard things, it doesn't really matter what the other person does do or should do. It's our own hard thing, and so it's our own response. Well, this morning in the text that we have before us, we're going to see two accounts of people going through their own significant trials. One, the first, would be of a centurion who is about to lose his valued servant. And then the other account is a widow who has just lost her son. Now, as we go through our text this morning, we're going to see two main things today. First, the faith required for hardships. The faith required for hardships. And then second, we're going to see the Lord who gets us through those hardships. First, the faith required. Second, the Lord who gets us through. All right, are you ready? Should we start? Let's begin. Read with me Luke chapter 7, verses 1 through 3. After he, that's Jesus, had finished all his sayings in the hearing of the people, he entered Capernaum. Now a centurion had a servant who was sick and at the point of death, who was highly valued by him. When the centurion heard about Jesus, he sent him elders of the Jews, asking him to come and heal his servant. All right, well, our first account takes place in the town of Capernaum. Jesus has just finished giving the Sermon on the Plain, of which you remember we spent the last 3 weeks looking at. And now he enters in the town and gets stopped by a convoy of Jews who were sent to him. Now, this unnamed local centurion is the one who sent the Jews. Centurions were commanders in the Roman army that held an authority over 100 soldiers, hence the name centurion. And essentially, they held authority over not only just the 100 men they had, but only over any place that they set up their shop there. So, as a result of their service in the Roman army, centurions earned a significant amount of money. In fact, they earned upwards to 10 to 20 times a normal day laborer's wage. Now, it appears that our centurion this morning is a little bit unique because he has gained the respect and good reputation among these Jews of Capernaum. And so they were sent on his behalf. Well, what's his request? His request is that Jesus would heal his highly valued servant. Now, it's interesting to note that here in the Greek, the word for heal, it comes from the Greek word for save. So, in other words, he asks Jesus, would you save my servant? And save he does. Now, our centurion has previously heard about Jesus, but evidently he's never actually seen him or interacted with him. And even so, his hearing about Jesus is enough to cause an inkling of faith that results in him sending for Jesus. But notice here, he does not send for Jesus until he has a crisis in his life. In other words, he doesn't realize his need until that hardship is right in his face. And so some may ask, well, then is this really faith? Or is it something else? Convenience. If he doesn't send for Jesus until now, is that faith really genuine? But the truth is, that's not necessarily a bad thing. Because in fact, this seems to be the normal way that most people come to faith in Jesus. We go through a trial, a challenge. We go through something heartbreaking. We get knocked off our feet and we're thrown into despair. And so we reach out to Jesus. I'd like to take a moment and pause and say that it behooves us to be aware of our emotions and our inner thoughts. Why do I say that? Well, it's not uncommon to ignore what's really happening on the inside. And so we try to alleviate our nebulous bad feeling by distracting ourselves with something else. We do it because trials are hard. They hurt. Hardships have this uncanny ability to dig up things in our souls that we would rather not deal with. And so, we don't deal with it. We choose something easier to distract ourselves from the pain. Instead of sending for Jesus, we send for the bottle, the media, the food, the arms of another, or the facade of life that has it together. But when we pause, recognize and evaluate our emotions and our inner thoughts, it gives us the very space and ability to face our hardships head on. It gives us the space to send for Jesus rather than something else to numb the pain. You see, it's in the moments of the greatest heartache that end up being the moments of the greatest faith building, when we face them head on. And so, for this centurion here, who loves his dying servant, he experiences a spark of faith, and he sends for Jesus. So what kind of faith is required for hardships? A faith that sends for Jesus. As simple as that. Read with me verses 4 through 7. And when they came to Jesus, they pleaded with him earnestly, saying, "He is worthy to have you do this for him, for he loves our nation, and he is the one who built us our synagogue." And Jesus went with them. When he was not far from the house, the centurion sent friends, saying to him, "Lord, do not trouble yourself, for I am not worthy to have you come under my roof." Well, our story continues on. The Jews come to Jesus and reason that it only would make sense that Jesus would heal the centurion's servant. In fact, for the Jews, it's more than it only makes sense. For them, it's become an obligation. It was common, in that time to operate under something known as a gift obligation framework. So in other words, if I give you a gift, I have you in my debt. You are obligated to compensate me with something that fits my desires. If I give you what you want, then you are obligated to give me what I want. So the Jews, they come to Jesus and tell him that this particular centurion is worthy of Jesus' time. See, he loves the nation of Israel. And he's already given so much. This guy, he's generously built their synagogue. And remember, the synagogue of Capernaum, probably the one that Jesus himself has taught in himself. Under this gift obligation framework, worthiness is based on what the centurion has accomplished. Because he has done so much, he is worthy. Now, I'm sure you can see how this would play out for the Jewish religious leaders in terms of spirituality. We give to God what we think he wants, and he is to give us what we want. We serve him, and so he saves us. But this is the definition of what false religion looks like. Trying to put God in our debts because we have gifted him with our service, so to speak. It's like when we negotiate relief from our present hard circumstances because we think we deserve it. God, relieve this. You owe it to me. I've served you. I find this passage really fascinating because the Jews claim the centurion is worthy, but the centurion decidedly says he is unworthy. That's a little funny. He tells Jesus in verse 6, quote, "I am not worthy to have you come under my roof." Therefore, we as readers should assume that the centurion will continue with something like, "I am unworthy, so don't come and don't heal my servant," right? But that would just be using the gift obligation framework, right? Because he's not worthy, Jesus does not have to heal. But if he was worthy, then Jesus would have to heal. It's a framework of works rather than a framework of grace. We see this kind of thing in our culture as well. It's the person who struggles receiving gifts from others. If they receive a meal from another person, they feel bound to give a meal back. But it's also the person who understands their spiritual worthiness in terms of what they do or by what they believe. Like, "I'm a good guy because I'm mostly kind to others and my friends really like me." Or, "I'm loved by God because I don't have any doubts." By the way, a framework of works is also the opposite, and that is, "I'm not loved by God because occasionally I do have doubts." That is a framework of performance and works as well. Okay, but notice what the centurion says, and I love this here. He says, "I'm not worthy, so don't come to my house, but please heal my servant anyways." He recognizes he is unworthy, but banks everything on Jesus being gracious. As you can see, a framework of works will never help someone endure hardship. Someone with a framework of performance will feel hopelessly stuck if they're too heartbroken to pray or read their Bible. Someone with a framework of performance will feel hopelessly condemned if they're so stressed that they keep blowing up at everyone else. But if your framework is one of grace, well then, you could be like the centurion, say, "I am not worthy. I mess up all the time. I fail constantly. But please give me your grace anyway. Not because what have I've done, but because of who you are." What kind of faith is required for hardships? A faith that banks on the grace of Jesus, not one of works. Read with me verses 8 through 10. "For I too am a man set under authority," says the centurion, "with soldiers under me. And I say to one, 'Go,' and he goes. I say to another one, 'Come,' and he comes. And I say to my servant, 'Do this,' and he does it." When Jesus heard these things, he marveled at him. And turning to the crowd that followed him, said, "I tell you, not even Israel have I found such faith. And when those who had been sent returned to the house, they found the servant well. Just incredible. I mean, truly, what the centurion says is just incredible. I mean, even Jesus thinks so. Verse 9, Jesus says, it says rather that Jesus marveled at him. That word, marvel, it describes an emotional response. Like if we said we're blown away by something, like Jesus was blown away by the centurion's response, it's emotional. And what's so incredible about it? His response, or the centurion's words. Well, he evidences a deep understanding. He sees what others don't. Now remember, the centurion, he's a commander in the Roman army of 100 men, as well as having many servants. So he is a man with authority, and as a man with authority, he sees it and recognizes it in Jesus. But that's not all. He doesn't just recognize Jesus' authority. He also relies on Jesus' authority. He declares that Jesus only needs to say a word and his servant will be healed. And that's exactly what happened. His servant is healed. Not because Jesus touched him. Not because of some magical incantation he has to do. But because Jesus possessed the authority to do so. And not even distance can thwart that authority. So what's the big deal about Jesus' authority? What weight does it bear on the fact that we may be going through a trial? Okay, well, let me ask you a question then, if you're going to ask me that question. Question back right at you. How much authority or control do you have over your life in the middle of a hardship? None. Absolutely none. We are totally out of control. Trials happen when others betray us, or when the march of time takes its toll on our bodies without our consent, or when our paycheck is no longer a match for economic inflation. Hardships happen to us. And by the way, even if that hardship happened because I did something, because you did something, let's say like ongoing sin, well, even the aftermath and the consequences are out of our control. You see, no matter what it is, no one can exercise oversight in the middle of a trial. But just because we lack control, it doesn't mean our situation is hopeless. Because God is always in control. I mean, just consider for a moment the example of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, found in Daniel chapter 3. Babylon was the world's superpower at the time, and the man at the top with all the authority was King Nebuchadnezzar. So he built this 90-foot-tall gold statue that not only represented idolatrous worship, but also stood for his great might and power as the king of the world. And when the music was played, everyone was required to bow down and worship the statue. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego refused to bow down. And so when Nebuchadnezzar heard about this, he burned with fury and ordered them to be bound and thrown in a fiery furnace. However, as you know, I'm sure, God miraculously saved them from the fiery trial. In return, Nebuchadnezzar promoted them and blessed God. I'd like to state the obvious. In the midst of being bound and peering into the fiery furnace, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were totally out of control. And yet, they did not grasp for control. They did not argue. They did not try to play gymnastics with their words to gain some more control back. Instead, they recognized and they relied on a greater authority, God's authority. Listen to what they told King Nebuchadnezzar in Daniel chapter 3, verses 16 through 18. They say this, quote, "Our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace and will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But if not, be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image you have set up." So in other words, they say to the king, whether we burn or not, we bow to God's authority, not yours. That's faith. That's faith. They're peering down to a fiery trial, and they say, God's authority. I'm not going to grasp for it. I'm not going to try to manipulate the situation. I bow to God. Having faith in God does not promise deliverance from trials. But faith does recognize and rely on God and His authority. Without it, without faith, we will be tempted to rely on ourselves and grasp for control. We must recognize and rely on Jesus' authority in hardships and trials. So, what kind of faith is required for hardships? Faith that recognizes and relies on Jesus' authority. As you can see, we all have hardships. And faith is important. We must exercise that faith. And as we've seen, that faith must be in Jesus, in the Lord. So now let's turn and take a closer look at the Lord who gets us through those hardships. Read with me. Our next account, Luke chapter 7, verse 11 through 13. Soon afterwards, he went to a town called Nain, and his disciples and a great crowd went with him. As he drew near to the gate of the town, behold, a man who had died was being carried out, the only son of his mother, and she was a widow, and a considerable crowd from the town was with her. And when the Lord saw her, he had compassion on her and said to her, "Do not weep." Once in Capernaum, now in a little town of Nain, Jesus and his followers arrive and they see a funeral procession of a young man that has recently died. His mother, who's a widow, is joined with the rest of the town as they mourn. This account's really interesting when you actually compare it with the one previous, with the centurion. The centurion, he sends for Jesus twice. He confesses Jesus' authority, and so he exercises faith. And then Jesus, he responds by coming, at least most of the way, and then he heals his servant. Here, but in this story here with the widow, she never seeks out Jesus. She never even speaks to him. We never see her exercise faith. It is Jesus who seeks her and does everything in this story. And so we come to an important lesson. We have a Lord who seeks us. Oh yes, faith does look like us seeking out Jesus. But in the amazing grace and mercy of our Lord, Jesus also seeks us. He doesn't leave us behind. He doesn't leave us alone. He meets us, even in the darkness. And that's exactly what we read in the account of the widow burying her only son. She has nothing to offer, nothing to her name, except for loads of grief. And Jesus saw her. Verse 13, that's what it says. Jesus saw her. Friend in a trial, Jesus sees you. He sees you. Jesus saw her, and so he sought her out. if you're in the middle of tremendous loss and hardship, you know personally what it feels like. You know what loneliness feels like. Sure, other people have experienced pain before, but it's different to experience it yourself. It's personal. It feels deeper than we ever imagined. Not only is it deeper, it's also distinct, because every situation is different. And no one can experience the exact same thing. And so because it's distinct, it feels lonely. But the astonishing thing is, we're not alone. Jesus is with us. He looks to bring you healing. He looks to bring you mercy. So I say it again. What kind of Lord is He? He is the Lord who seeks us. He is the Lord that seeks us, friends. But that's not all. Read with me again, verse 13. This is incredible. Verse 13. And when the Lord saw her, He had compassion on her. And He said to her, "Do not weep." He sees her, and then He is overwhelmed with compassion. To lose a loved one is bad enough. But for the people of this time, for the women of this time, it goes to a whole new level. For a woman to lose her husband and her only son was devastating. She had no means of support. Her social status and place in the community would have been severely diminished, if not totally lost. For all intents and purposes, she would have, as one commentator said, become an orphaned parent. But Jesus sees her, and He is overcome with compassion. I suspect that when Jesus saw her grieving the death of her son, He thought of death itself. Death is not natural. It's not right. It was never part of God's creation plan. He hates death. And that's why Jesus came. He came so He could conquer death. And so He sees her grieving death, and He's overcome with compassion. We tend to be people who think of Jesus in terms of what He does. He died for us. He rose for us. That's a good thing. It's an amazing thing. That's the gospel. We think of Jesus in terms of what He does for us. But let us not ignore what Jesus feels for us. Friends, we have a Lord who feels compassion for you. For you. In the midst of heartache and hardship, Jesus feels compassion for you. But how could He know what I'm going through? No one knows. I'm alone. The book of Hebrews tells us that Jesus was made like us in every way so that He might be merciful to us. Later in the book, the writer tells us that He is able to sympathize with us, having the same weaknesses that we have, yet without sin. And then still later in Hebrews, the writer draws a parallel between human priests of old and Jesus, the great high priest. The writer says this: He can deal gently with the ignorant and the wayward, since He Himself is beset with weaknesses. The implication is that Jesus is gentle with us, because He too has experienced what we have. He has experienced betrayal and loss, pain and abuse, hatred and temptation, weariness and frustration. He's been there. He knows our need. He knows our need for compassion. And thank God, because He is the Lord who is compassionate. By the way, how does Jesus show his compassion for the widow? He tells her to stop weeping. Now, normally, this is extremely offensive. Is it not? Right? You get around someone that's weeping, don't ever tell them to stop weeping. In fact, tell them it's healthy and good to weep, and then weep with them. So, why does Jesus get to say that? It's because he has the authoritative power to back it up. Read with me the last verses of our passage today, starting in verse 14. And then he came and touched the bier, and the bearers stood still, and he said, "Young man, I say to you, arise." And the dead man sat up and began to speak, and Jesus gave to him his mother. For fear seized them all, and they glorified God, saying, "A great prophet has risen among us, and God has visited his people." And this report about him spread through the whole of Judea and all the surrounding country. We have a Lord who is powerful. Jesus comes up to the man and touches the bier. The bier at that time was just a plank that was used to transport the body to the place of burial. It appears that he touched the bier to stop the pallbearers. But notice, he never touched the body. He spoke to it. He told the body to arise, and the man arose. Just as the centurion confessed that Jesus need only to say a word and his servant be healed, so here, Jesus speaks directly to the body, and he is resuscitated. Immediately, emphatically, he sat up. He began to speak. He was restored to his mother. There is only one person who can do this. And you have to see the logic here. If Jesus is able to do such a thing as to make a man rise from the dead, then he is able to handle any of our trials. He's not an impotent Lord. This does not surely mean that he will bear the full power of his authority on our hardships, but it does mean that he can. We are not a people without hope. We are a people who serve a Lord who is powerful and capable, which means not only do we have a Lord who is powerful, but we have a Lord who is worthy of all praise. That's exactly what the people did when they saw this powerful miracle. Quote, fear seized them all, and they glorified God. End quote. They recognized that something was important, something special about him. And so they worshiped God, and they called him a prophet. But we recognize that there's something even greater about him. He is not just a prophet, he is God himself. And so we worship him. What kind of Lord is he, friends? He is the Lord who is powerful and worthy of all praise. For many here in our world that we interact with on a daily basis, this world is all they have. They live without the hope of a resurrection. And so their trials and their hardships are particularly hard because their experience here is the best that they will ever have. But we are not a people without hope. We know the reality. We know the Lord. We know that this Lord is not all that there is. Jesus raised the widow's son up from the dead. But his resuscitation was not permanent. He experienced death once again. But our resurrection will be permanent. The death of our bodies is only temporary. We await the day when Jesus comes back and will make our lowly bodies like his glorious body. For I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worth comparing to the glory that is to be revealed to us. For the sufferings of this present time do not compare. Think about that. Do not compare to the glory. By faith, we are people that bank our whole lives on the resurrection of Jesus. Truly, truly, he is the Lord and worthy of all praise. Let's pray together. Jesus, we do praise you. All the glory and honor belong to you. Thank you that you saw us. Thank you that you came to us here. Thank you that you had compassion for us on the cross. Thank you that you raised from the dead and you share that resurrection power with us. I pray, Lord, that you would bear that resurrection power in us in our trials right now. Many of us go through trials and hardships. Many have experienced loss. Many are experiencing challenges with others. Many are experiencing heartaches here. So bear your resurrection power in us, I pray. Change us. You are worthy of all praise. In Jesus' name.